Happy Friday. This is The Takeaway for Friday, September 8th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us on this Friday. Florida has spent the last couple of days evacuating residents and tourists as Category 5 Hurricane Irma bears down on the coast. Florida Governor Rick Scott has been traveling the state, appearing on morning talk shows to alert Floridians of impending danger.
We're starting to do evacuation orders, and we'll be going up the coast as we see this hurricane get closer and closer to our state. The Keys have already, they're already evacuating, but we're making sure everybody's getting out. We're providing transportation if you don't have it.
The Florida Keys that Rick Scott is talking about there, they make up a chain of islands off the southern tip of Florida. The land there sits just an average of 6 feet above sea level. There's one major road connecting Key West to the mainland, and County Administrator Roman Gastesi warned that anyone who stayed in the Keys as Irma approached was risking their own life.
I certainly expect people to leave, and if they don't leave, we are telling them that they're on their own because we're leaving. We're not going to be with something like that. Nobody's going to be here, and you can't expect our first responders to risk their lives for their irresponsibility. So we're telling them now, we're telling them very boldly, very straightforward, and if they're going to stay, you're on your own.
That's County Administrator Roman Gastesi on CNN issuing a stark warning to Floridians in the Keys and elsewhere. Nancy Klingener is Florida Keys reporter for WLRN Miami and a longtime resident of Key West herself. Nancy, welcome.
Hi, Todd.
That was, as I said, a very stark warning from local officials. Are people paying attention?
Absolutely. I would say most people are leaving, which is unusual for evacuations in the Keys, even though they are mandatory evacuations. A lot of times people will stay and ride it out, but in this case, a huge number of people have hit the road.
What are things looking like now around your area, not only in terms of the weather, but in terms of how people are preparing, what they're doing to their houses and their businesses?
Almost everybody's boarded up, obviously, and people are making contingency plans, making sure they have food and water and batteries and things like that.
Is there a great deal of traffic on the roads heading north to Miami?
The traffic on the overseas highway hasn't been a huge clog. The clogs are coming once you hit the mainland because, of course, there are just so many people up there and so many of them are also evacuating.
Describe the terrain around your area, what it looks like there, and why the Keys might be so very vulnerable to this storm.
Well, the Keys are very low-lying islands. The highest point on the island might be 18 feet. So a storm surge that gets that high or even 10 feet can knock out a huge majority of our buildings and wash over everything.
Now, Nancy Klingener, you're a reporter, but you're also a longtime resident of Key West yourself, as I mentioned. Talk a little bit about yourself for a second and your family. What are you going to do?
It looks like we're going to stay and ride it out. And that's been a decision that's been changing, not changing, but that's been a decision that we've been reconsidering at every point. And part of it is that I live here. I'm a reporter. And when the biggest story ever comes to your home and your beat, it seems like you should be there to cover it. But I'm absolutely not advocating that for other people, to make that clear.
And at the same time, Nancy Klingener, you are a reporter and you want the story. Believe me, I understand that. That warning from the county administrator, Roman Gastesi, that we played at the top was unequivocal. You're deciding to stay anyway.
Absolutely. The thing that could get really ugly isn't so much the storm itself as the aftermath. If we lose one of the bridges, or more than one of the bridges, that connects the Keys, we'd be cut off from the mainland. We could lose our water supply. It could be really, really ugly and uncomfortable down here. But there are people here. There will be stories. And I wouldn't be able to get back if I had left.
What are you doing for shelter then during the storm? What's the plan?
We have a place that we think is pretty strong and pretty secure. And that's where I'll be.
Is there a particular culture in the Keys that leads people to want to stay and ride it out? They see a lot of storms, whereas this one's different?
There is. Certainly islanders have a certain level of independence that I think maybe other folks don't have. A lot of people here are boaters. They think of themselves as self-sufficient. But there's also just the fear of getting on that road and getting to the mainland and can you get fuel and will you be stuck and all that stuff. And I think that's one of the big reasons some people at least are expecting to stay. There's also the fact that the track lately looks to be going over the middle and upper Keys, certainly, but Key West itself is right on the edge of the cone. Everybody knows, I hope, that these things move and change and that we're still, I'm sure, going to feel some significant impacts. But people here feel like they are safer than they might be in Miami, for instance.
Now, you mentioned, though, the danger. Nobody knows the track that Irma will take. But if it does hit further up the chain toward the mainland, there is a danger that Key West, all the way out on the end where you are, would be cut off.
There is. And I know that that's a major concern for our local emergency managers, not just because of what the consequences for survival would be, but also because if all of South Florida has suffered a catastrophic blow, they're saying that we would probably not be on the top of the priority list for repairs.
How many other people, Nancy Klingener, do you know who are going to ride out this storm like you?
Dozens, at least, I think it's safe to say, that I know personally.
That's scary to hear, I have to be honest.
It is. It is very scary. It's kind of the worst case scenario of living in South Florida and especially choosing to live at this tiny dot at the end of the road. You always sort of know this could happen and you'll have to make choices when it does.
Still, does this storm, the forecasts of it, feel different than other storms that you've no doubt encountered living in Key West?
It does, just because of its potential to affect such a huge area so badly. I mean, they're evacuating people from below Lake Okeechobee. And normally when a storm comes, it's going to hit somewhere, but it's the other places will be there and able to help recover. And this one just looks so huge and so dangerous that I have no idea what's going to happen.
So, Nancy Klingener, what do preparations then look like between now and the time Irma is expected to hit? I know you've got a job to do. You're doing it right now, and we appreciate it. But you've also got a family and a home to protect, I'm sure.
Right, yeah. We're sort of sorting our preparations into stay at home if it were to veer north and not really look like a big impact for the Keys, or take shelter, take refuge, and packing up, you know, personal belongings, gear bags, all that stuff, securing what really matters.
Nancy Klingener is Florida Keys reporter for WLRN in Miami and a longtime resident of Key West. Nancy, thank you for being with us, and please take care and be careful during the storm.
Thanks, Todd.
A short way up the Florida coastline to Miami now, where more than 700,000 people are under evacuation orders in anticipation of Hurricane Irma. Nearly half of all people in Miami-Dade County live in a high-risk flood zone. The city sits just a few feet above sea level, but it's seen its population explode in recent years. Mayor Philip Stoddard is the mayor of South Miami. That's one of the 34 incorporated cities of Miami-Dade County. He's also a biology professor at Florida International University. Mayor Stoddard, thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here. I've heard the show so many times.
Well, we appreciate you being with us, and I know it's a difficult time. Mr. Mayor, what are some of the preparations going on right now in South Miami and the surrounding communities preparing for Irma? What's it look like?
Well, we just got the word yesterday that most of us are under an evacuation order. It was rather a surprise. And we're under evacuation orders because of concerns about storm surge. National Hurricane Center has modeled the surge for Irma, and they think that there's a decent chance, given the angles of this storm and its strength, that it's going to push a lot of water up Biscayne Bay and right up the canal system and into the cities. So they're telling everybody to get out, but there isn't enough shelter space. So they're going to have to open up more shelters. And a lot of people are probably in areas that are well above any potential water line. So I've been putting together the Hurricane Center's maps and getting them out to residents so they can actually see for themselves whether they're in a high area or a low area.
Mr. Mayor, there's a risk there, it seems, giving people maps if they're in a high area or a low area that they might decide for themselves they're high enough and stay put when they shouldn't.
Everybody ultimately decides for themselves, and everybody ultimately has to take responsibility for themselves. The danger is that people in low areas will say, well, it's never flooded before, so I'm staying put. I'm not worried about the people at high areas staying put. I'm worried about the people in low areas staying put.
Well, Mayor Stoddard, with the projections of a storm surge coming up Biscayne Bay, as you described, what does significant storm surge mean for Miami and its geography?
Well, the people out along the coastline, Miami Beach, they're facing potentially very high water, you know, 6 feet, 9 feet of water. For people who are farther inland, you get a secondary sort of surge where you don't get the big bolus of water piling up on the coast and washing over. What you get is seepage, essentially that mountain of water that gathers up on the shoreline, then has to go somewhere. And if the winds are still pushing it from the water side, it's going to dissipate inland. And so people will see water slowly seeping in and rising up underneath them.
Mayor Stoddard, let's talk a little bit about South Miami and Miami and how it's built and how that comes into play when a storm like this shows up. Does your area have seawalls? Would it matter if they did?
Well, we do not have seawalls, and it would not matter if we did, particularly because there's canals. And, you know, South Florida was built on a series of limestone ridges. And the gaps in that ridge are called transverse glades, where the Everglades used to let out into Biscayne Bay. Those are now canals, and the water can still come up those transverse glades through the canals and then seep into the city. So we have holes in our holes in our fortress.
There have been some recent analyses, Mayor Stoddard, and I know you've seen them, suggesting that an Andrew strength storm, Hurricane Andrew from 1992, would be far more catastrophic now than Andrew was then. And the reason for that is that the population in South Florida has just exploded in the meantime by 6 million people. Far more buildings, more numerous, closer together, and a lot more people, which just means potentially a lot more damage.
Well, there's two things. There's more people in harm's way. There's more buildings in harm's way. We do have better hurricane codes. The Florida building code was strengthened considerably, so there's better construction standards and better inspections. So it's one versus the other. Then the third factor is that you could not have aimed a powerful hurricane more accurately than it is being aimed at us right now to do the maximum amount of damage. I mean, if Andrew was a bowling ball coming through South Dade, this thing's a wrecking ball.
Well, Mayor Philip Stoddard, I appreciate you taking the time to join us. I know it's a difficult time and you have to get to preparations. What will you be doing during the storm? What are your plans?
During the storm, I'm going to sit tight. The mayor goes down with his ship, so people have asked if I'm leaving town. No, I'm sticking it out here. We've released all of our city staff. The police are on duty. City manager and I are staying.
Mayor Stoddard, I say this respectfully, and I know that you've thought of it, but the orders from the state are to get out or you're on your own, and I wonder if you're sure that's the best example for residents and citizens in your area.
Well, sometimes you just have to make sure that you're there to take care of the people who need to be taken care of. And there's people who won't get out and people who can't get out, and I've got to be here to deal with it.
Mayor Philip Stoddard is the mayor of South Miami. Mr. Mayor, be safe and be careful, please.
You bet. Thanks for calling.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick, and some new developments now in President Donald Trump's decision to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, known as DACA. A number of conservative state attorneys general may have helped force the president's hand in ending DACA when they threatened to sue the administration if it kept the program. But now a different group of 16 other attorneys general are also going to court to stop the president from ending DACA. Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson is a Democrat, and he's one of those leading the lawsuit against the administration. And he says the claim stands on multiple grounds.
We have constitutional claims, due process and equal protection, constitutional provisions. We also are asserting statutory claims. In other words, we're saying the president has violated federal statutes. So we have multiple claims, and we feel we have good legal arguments to stop this action by the president.
Now, there were lots of arguments on the other side of this, as you know, that the original DACA program itself from President Obama was an unconstitutional reach by the president. But you're arguing quite the opposite, that undoing the program is unconstitutional. Why?
You raise an important point. A lot of people say, including Attorney General Sessions, that the original DACA program by the president was unlawful. In fact, that's what they rely on, Attorney General Sessions and the president, to roll it back. There's just one problem with that, Todd. No court has ever actually ruled that DACA is unconstitutional. And moreover, the Department of Justice itself, the federal government, has for years defended it. So part of our argument is, given that the decision by the president is what we call, as lawyers call, arbitrary and capricious. There is no real reason behind it, and that's one of our arguments behind our complaint that we filed.
But if President Obama's claim was that the president has primary discretion over immigration policy like this, therefore he had the right to do DACA, doesn't it follow that the next president, President Trump, has the right to undo it?
No, in a couple different ways. And I'll try and keep this high level because, you know, on these legal complaints, it does get fairly technical fairly quickly. But one argument that we have is that, and this is similar to the travel ban litigation, when I filed a lawsuit to stop the first travel ban, and we won on stopping that first travel ban. One of our arguments there, for example, is that one can have an agency action or an action by a president, for example, that is seemingly lawful but is made unlawful if it is motivated in part, Todd, by a racial animus, for example, or an improper motive. Doesn't have to be the motivating factor. The courts require a motivating factor, and we argue that with the travel ban, that his animus towards Muslim Americans. We have a similar argument here. In other words, the president has been very clear what his views are of Mexicans. He kicked off his campaign with essentially a rant against Mexicans, murderers, rapists, that type of thing. So it's our view that that, even if it's otherwise legal what he's doing, it has an improper purpose. And the question I pose to your listeners is, you know, the overwhelming majority of Dreamers are from Mexico, about 80%. Does anyone really think that if most of the Dreamers were white, that Donald Trump would have taken the action he took the other day? I don't think so.
Some legal experts who've looked at your case say you've got kind of a difficult argument here, primarily because the president hasn't technically taken anything away. They've simply said this is going to expire, and if you don't renew after 6 months, we won't be taking any new applications.
Yeah, so I guess a couple of responses that, number one, I've now filed 15 lawsuits against this administration. Each one presents, and each lawsuit in general presents its own unique challenges. But in the 15 we filed, so far we won 4 and lost none. We're 4-0. So number one, on each of those, most people have said, oh, it'll never work, including the travel ban, and yet we've been successful. So I appreciate folks' feedback, but we feel we have good legal arguments here. Moreover, it's the view of our legal team that yes, this is ripe. In other words, a court can act now because privacy information of Dreamers is in jeopardy as well. As one of our arguments as well, which is very important, is that the federal government, in setting up this program, invited Dreamers to provide very personal information about where they live and where they work and where they go to school. And the president has made no assurance that that information won't be used against them as they try to wind this program down. That is a true betrayal of those individuals to invite them to join a program, ask for information, have it supplied to the federal government, and then turn around and use it against those Dreamers.
All right. Well, Bob Ferguson, let's step outside your brief just for a second. Right after this decision was rendered, the Attorney General Jeff Sessions told the press about getting rid of DACA. And then a series of tweets from President Trump saying, look, DACA recipients, nothing will happen to you over the next 6 months. Don't worry. I'm going to work with Nancy Pelosi. If Congress doesn't fix this, I will. He seemed to backtrack. He says he's not backtracking. But I wonder if you haven't gotten sort of into his brain a little bit.
Well, I won't take any credit for that. But I think who I hope is getting into his brain a little bit is just the outpouring of opposition to his decision from individuals and communities and organizations and businesses all around this country. That, I think, hopefully has gone into his head. And I think there's a good chance that is what caused him to do that follow-up tweet, as you said, that he'll revisit this issue in 6 months if Congress doesn't act. And to that point, in our complaint, we have businesses in my home state, like Starbucks and Amazon, who have filed complaints, who filed declarations, excuse me, to support our complaint. We have organizations like our universities and our colleges. They're all talking about the adverse impact to those colleges, to those universities, or to those businesses if this is allowed to go forward. So there is strong opposition to what the president has done, and I hope that has what has gone into his head.
Well, maybe the most effective thing you could do as an attorney general, I mean, you have a direct line to your senators and your congressional delegation. Most of them probably agree with you on this, but it seems like Congress could undo this debate right away and that maybe a bona fide negotiation over extending DACA might be taking place in the House and Senate. And if that happens, you don't need a lawsuit.
oh, hey, from my standpoint, if Congress does its job, right, and provides the protections that these dreamers deserve, I am 110% behind that, and I hope they do it. That said, I just don't have a lot of confidence in this particular Congress to tackle a big challenge facing our country. I don't mean any disrespect by that. I just look back at past actions and just don't see that happening. I hope it does. I'll do whatever I can to support that. But in the meantime, I, as Attorney General, representing those 17,000 dreamers in my own state, cannot wait around for a dysfunctional Congress to address this. If we feel we have good legal arguments and Washingtonians are being harmed, then I feel I have an obligation, really a duty, to stand up and do something about it.
Bob Ferguson, the Attorney General of Washington State, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Todd. Really appreciate it.
Labor Day means fall television here in America. You know, not as much as it used to, because so many shows have these staggered releases now. But there are still new shows in the fall that you need to know about. And that's why Melissa Locker is here, culture reporter for Time and for us here at The Takeaway. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Todd.
Well, let's start with the new show coming out from HBO. This is The Deuce. This is Maggie Gyllenhaal and Method Man, for short, Mr. Meth.
I'm doing fine.
Fine ain't good enough for a woman like you. Hey, I'll make you a star. Hallie McGraw gonna want your autograph.
That's the Method Man from the Wu-Tang Clan there, who's been in some comedies. He was in The Wire, some acting experience.
Yeah, and so this show reunites him with David Simon, who, of course, created The Wire, as well as George Pelicanos, who wrote a bunch of the episodes for The Wire. And it stars James Franco and Maggie Gyllenhaal. From what I've seen so far, it's really good. It's obviously not for the children. It's about, you know, the seedy underbelly of the rise and fall of the porn industry in New York, 1970s New York. So there's definitely, you know, watch this late at night when the children are asleep.
Now, we're talking Law and Order. Can I get a clang clang? There it is. Melissa, this is Edie Falco in Law and Order True Crime covering the Menendez murders.
Right. The way I figured that this show came about is that Dick Wolf was sitting around suddenly realizing that Ryan Murphy was getting in on all his action and taking over all the great true crime stories, and so decided, hey, you know what? I need in on this. I'm taking the Menendez brothers case.
Law & Order has spent years ripping stories from the headlines, so these are the actual headlines. People will remember Edie Falco from The Sopranos.
Yeah, of course. And I think that, you know, don't let your children watch this one either, because they might get some ideas, because it's these two boys who are horribly abused by their parents and then ended up killing them both, which I don't think is a spoiler because it happened way back in like 1989.
So that's Law and Order. I loved Dynasty as a kid, I have to confess. And I guess I should have known that this one was ripe for a reboot.
I don't ever want you to come into this house again unless you're invited. Is that understood?
Careful, Crystal. You're beginning to sound the tiniest bit jealous. Don't worry. You can have Blake. I just want the mansion.
That sounds like old Dynasty. That sounded like Linda Evans and Joan Collins.
Yep, that was an old clip. Just to remind you of the glamour, the glory, and the shoulder pads.
And the hair.
And the hair. It was so good. And of course, it was primed for a reboot. So the show is now set in Atlanta. It's still the same world of these two powerful families, the Carringtons and the Colbys, battling it out over money, business, family, love. Probably, you know, I assume there's going to be a slap fight in a fountain at some point.
America has no idea how badly it still needs Dynasty, but it's about to find out. Finally, Mindhunter is the new offering from Netflix, and this is David Fincher.
It's not easy butchering people. It's hard work. Physically and mentally, I don't think people realize you need to vent.
That's Mindhunter, new on Netflix from director David Fincher. Sounds a bit foreboding there, Melissa.
Yeah, and I think it's supposed to be. I mean, David Fincher, of course, is the guy who brought us Zodiac and Gone Girl. Like, he knows creepy, creepy drama. And this show is set in 1979, which is at the tail end of The Son of Sam and the Manson family. And it's two FBI agents who are kind of tasked with helping police learn how to profile serial killers. So I think it's supposed to be dark. It's supposed to be foreboding. It's supposed to be scary. It looks pretty good from what I've seen so far. They haven't released very much of it online, but it's coming out in October, so perfect for Halloween viewing.
If you've got time for just one out of these four, out of The Deuce, out of The New Dynasty, out of Mindhunter, or out of the new Law and Order, Melissa?
I think you have to go with The Deuce. I mean, David Simon and George Pelicanos back on HBO is pretty much mandatory viewing.
Four new options for your fall viewing. But if you have time for just one, it's The Deuce with James Franco and Maggie Gyllenhaal and The Method Man, according to Melissa Locker. Thanks for being here, Melissa.
Thank you, Todd.
Melissa Locker, culture reporter for Time and for us here at The Takeaway.
Hi, it's Jay.
Georgie.
Some kind of chemical explosion. Has to be.
Red rum! Red rum!
It's nothing to do with Satan, Mama. It's me.
Come play with us, Daddy.
No, Vern. There is something on your neck.
It's a leech.
Leeches!
Oh, my God!
Friday's movie day here on The Takeaway. Reefer Guzman is with me. He's film critic for Newsday and for The Takeaway. And I think that I heard an all Stephen King intro montage there. That's what I think I heard. Films from across the Stephen King anthology. And that's good, Reefer, because that's what we're talking about today. We have It, the remake adaptation of Stephen King's terrifying clown novel.
Yes.
Nobody has time for that. That's bad. And we have the exact opposite also. Reese Witherspoon is in a romantic comedy. We'll get to that as well. Rafer, let me give you some trivia and let me give you some Stephen King trivia to stick with the theme of this hour and Stephen King time here on The Takeaway.
All right.
Here is James Woods getting intimidated by a tough guy played by Alan King about his smoking. Listen.
You may see some of them all at a time. You may see all of them some of the time. But believe me, Mr. Morrison, you'll never see all of them all of the time. If you smoke, they'll see you.
And bring me down here and stick me in the old cat room, I suppose.
No. We'll bring your wife down here and stick her in a cat room. You get to watch.
All right, Rafer, that is a Stephen King movie, and I want you to name the film from Stephen King. And I'm going to tell you there are two possible answers that I will both accept. Don't answer now. If you know it, hit me up on Twitter. Rafer will come back to this. In the meantime, Rafer, we have to talk about It. We have to talk about this clown down the sewer. It's the remake of Stephen King's It. Here's a clip.
Hiya, Georgie. What a nice boat. Do you want it back?
Yes, please.
You look like a nice boy. Do you want a balloon too, Georgie?
Rafer, I know a lot of people in my life who just aren't going to tolerate this terrifying clown. How about you?
I mean, you know, yes, me too. Who isn't afraid of the scary clown, right? Well, you know, now I will say I want to preface this by saying you were the one that encouraged me to go watch the 1990 miniseries.
Absolutely, with Tim Curry.
With Tim Curry as Pennywise. So I think this is a great update of that miniseries. We're back in like classic Stephen King territory. Maybe not quite Stand By Me, but getting close. Group of kids in the small town in Maine who are battling this evil demon that manifests itself as their greatest fears and his main sort of manifestation is Pennywise the Clown. Great cast here. Great cast of kid actors. Jaden Lieberherr is in there from St. Vincent. There's a young girl from Brooklyn, Sophia Lillis, who plays Beverly, the sole girl in the group of kids. She is fantastic. This movie is a lot of fun. In a lot of ways, sort of a conventional horror film, but in a lot of ways not, because it's so much fun hanging out with these kids and going back to your childhood in the way that sort of great Stephen King way.
I enjoyed the trailer a lot, I will say, and it did have a Stranger Things feel to it.
Yes, or well, Stranger Things has a Stephen King feel.
It certainly does, you're right.
And it shares a Finn, I'm going to forget the kid's name, but it shares at least one cast member. At least one young cast member, yes.
That's It. From Stephen King. It's out, and yeah, I'm going to see that. Reese Witherspoon has a romantic comedy. It's called Home Again. Rafer, take a swing at it.
All right. This is a romantic comedy, as you say. Reese Witherspoon plays Alice. She's a woman who's in the middle of a divorce. She's got two kids. Falls for a young guy who's a filmmaker. He and his friends move into her house. They sort of form a family. I'm not really sure what this film was trying to be or trying to do until I realized that the writer and director is Hallie Myers Shire, who is the daughter of Nancy Myers, and she's trying to do one of her mom's films, sort of an It's Complicated, Something's Gotta Give. Doesn't work. I didn't understand this movie. I can't recommend it. Go see It.
And I'm not horribly disappointed by that news, I have to say. All right, while we're on the subject of It, Rafer, I played you a clip from a Stephen King film. It had James Woods. Listen.
Bring me down here and stick me in the old cat room, I suppose.
No. We'll bring your wife down here and stick her in a cat room. You get to watch.
There are two possible answers here, Rafer. What film?
Is that Creepshow?
That is not Creepshow. Good guess. That is Cat's Eye, 1985. In the vignette, it had three films within a film. That's Quitters Incorporated.
Right.
They will make you quit smoking, Rafer Guzman.
Remember the story.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Don.
The Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. And there's been a massive data breach, this time at one of the giant credit reporting agencies that generates Americans' credit scores. Equifax announced that the personal information of 143 million U.S. consumers was exposed through a cybersecurity breach. This is information like social security numbers, credit card numbers, birthdays, addresses, all potentially compromised. Kim Zetter joins me now. She's a journalist and author who covers cybersecurity for publications like Wired and The Washington Post and The Intercept. Kim, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
What do we know about this data breach so far and exactly what kinds of information was compromised?
We actually know very little about this so far. The information that's been coming out of Equifax is sparse and also very confusing. What they've told us is that approximately 143 million U.S. consumers have been impacted or potentially impacted. That doesn't mean that the data of 143 million was stolen. It simply means that the intruders had access likely to a database that included that amount of information. And the information includes social security numbers, names, addresses, birth dates, in some cases, driver's license numbers. And then in addition to that, they added that the credit card numbers for about 209,000 U.S. consumers were accessible. And 182,000 U.S. consumers' dispute reports were also accessed.
What could hackers do with that? I mean, the credit card information is fairly obvious. What can they do with the rest of it?
Well, with social security numbers and the addresses and names and all of that, what you can do is you can open false lines of credit for someone, either credit card accounts or bank loans, things like that. So that's always a concern because that kind of data, the social security numbers in particular, clearly it doesn't change. So even though Equifax is offering a one-year free credit monitoring service for people who might have been affected, that you know, having your social security number exposed doesn't end after a year. That's a lifetime of risk that you're looking at.
Well, I want to play you a statement from the CEO of Equifax, Rick Smith, who apologized immediately for the breach. Listen.
I deeply regret this incident, and I apologize to every affected consumer and all of our partners. We all know that the threats to data security are growing by the day. And while we've made significant investments in cybersecurity, we have more to do, and we will.
Kim Zetter, Equifax is one of these agencies where obviously millions of Americans put their personal information. It seems like it was a highly vulnerable and high-value target to begin with. And despite that statement from the CEO, it makes me wonder, how could this happen?
We don't really even know actually what happened. What they've said was that this involved a web application vulnerability. And so you can sort of parse through that statement and come to the conclusion that this is the kind of vulnerability that we find quite often in a lot of database breaches through websites. So there's a vulnerability in the website that allows someone, usually what happens is there's like an application where a consumer can get information about themselves through the website, but that the vulnerability makes it possible for someone to get information, not just about themselves, but about other people as well.
What insights do you have into the likely uses for information like this? I mean, it could be something as simple as opening lines of credit and stealing stuff. But there have been other high-profile breaches where the experts have said it's not really about stealing your credit score, it's more about research or data mining.
So that your social security number isn't just used for financial purposes also, but it's also used for your medical records. And so what we've seen in the past, what thieves have done with social security numbers is open lines of credit, open housing loans, bank loans, things like that, but also stolen insurance or applied for medical care using someone else's social security number, applying for fake tax returns in your name and in your social security number. So there are a lot of things that people actually can do with this data.
Is Equifax likely to survive this breach with so many tens of millions of Americans affected here?
Well, the problem here is that consumers don't choose to have their information controlled by Equifax. So consumers can't say, I'm going to take my business elsewhere and I'm going to take my information elsewhere. Equifax gets this information simply, you know, by you opening lines of credit and having a credit history. So there's nothing really that the consumers can do to control this. It's really going to be up to regulators to decide if they're going to apply more oversight of Equifax and require more reporting by Equifax. the sort of the haphazard nature of how companies report publicly the breaches and the amount of information that they provide, this has always been a problem. It's been a problem for decades. And I would think that, you know, having seen examples where companies have been more transparent, Equifax would have chosen that route. Really, they've been very obtuse in their response here. And even in the website that they set up to help consumers has raised additional problems. In fact, that consumers haven't been able to get clear information about whether their specific data was exposed or not.
Journalist and author Kim Zetter, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I'm Todd Zwillick. Welcome back to The Takeaway. School kids in New York City returned to classes yesterday, and when they did, they found a new policy in the New York City public schools. Starting this week, all of the city's 1.1 million public school students will receive free lunch. Here's Carmen Farina, the chancellor of the New York City public schools.
The average saving of money is $300 per family. This makes a difference, and particularly makes a difference at this time when many families are trying to figure out how to stretch their budget.
Now, the majority of school kids in New York qualify for free lunch, but officials noticed a problem. As kids get older, fewer and fewer of them eat the lunches that the schools provide. And the main reason, according to the city, is the stigma and the shame of receiving a free lunch in the first place.
I heard from students all throughout the city of New York. Children who were teased, children who had to stand on separate lines, children who were referred to as pole kids. These poor children, unfortunately, were stigmatized, they were made fun of, they were bullied, and some just decided not to have lunch at all.
That was New York City Public Schools advocate Letitia James describing what's become known in the city as food shaming. Ben Kalos went to the New York City public schools as a kid, and today he's a supporter of universal free lunch from his seat representing Manhattan's Upper East Side on the New York City Council. Ben Kalos is here with me in the studio. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me on The Takeaway. Longtime listener, excited to be on.
It's good to have you. How did this stigma, what people in New York now call lunch shaming, get so bad that schools in New York decided free lunch for everyone was the answer?
I grew up on the Upper East Side, and I went to a public school, the Bronx High School of Science, and I had a single mom, and I qualified for reduced lunch. And so back in the 90s in high school, I had to choose between food and friends, and sadly, I made the choice that all too many kids make of choosing friends over food and saying, oh, I'm not hungry, because the truth is I was starving. And in terms of how bad it's gotten, kids are participating less and less as they get older. It's about 81% in elementary school, 61% in middle school. But once you get to high school, it drops down to 38%. And all these kids are eligible for free or reduced school lunch.
And do we know that this reduced participation is because of the social shame that you're describing of not wanting to be one of the kids who gets free lunch in front of other kids?
There's a Lunch for Learning coalition, and I've had the opportunity to meet with parents and students from all over the city who were tired of being shamed, of being called the free, or other names. And it happened to me, so it struck a personal chord with me.
How much money is New York City paying to expand lunch for all school kids?
It's going to come out to about, I think the last estimate that we were looking at is it's about $40 million. And when a city has a budget of $85.2 billion, and we're talking about a federal government with trillions, feeding 1.1 million kids for $40 million isn't such a big deal. And the federal government is actually going to reimburse us for every single dollar we spend on free lunch at about 80 cents on the dollar. So any money we spend is going to come right back, and it's going to be a positive for the local economy. We're going to spend it on local food.
So it seems pretty clear, Ben Kalos, that this type of stigma over free lunch is a legitimate problem in New York. But a skeptic might look at this and say, this is a lot of money, even if it's $40 million, to address a problem. Couldn't the city, or the federal government for that matter, if that's your thing, spend a lot less money trying to educate kids and parents about free lunch and change the culture and the attitude around it, rather than just throwing a blanket over everybody and saying everybody gets free lunch?
When you're thinking about the 1.1 million kids, 75% of them qualify for free or reduced school lunch. So that's the magnitude of the number of meals. And when you talk about administrative overhead, we're probably spending a lot of money just to make sure that those 25% don't get that food. But when you have that 75% who qualify not really participating, about a third of those kids aren't even getting those meals, we can do more.
So the need to give kids three square meals a day is indisputable. And you say that 75% of kids in the New York City school system qualify here. That's a lot of kids, and they need lunch. There's no question about it. Going forward, what are the New York City schools doing to address this issue of the stigma in the first place? Because it's still going to be around, even if all the kids get free lunch. At some point in the future, the federal government's going to say, we don't have money for this. Or at some point in the future, these kids are going to go on to other schools. And it's the attitudes that really matter here, right?
We need to make sure that the quality and the culture in the schools is improved. And I think having one less thing to have kids bullied on when there's so many different things out there will have a huge impact. And one thing that's important to mention is we've got about 22,000 children who woke up this morning in a homeless shelter and are in our public schools, and they've already got it pretty tough. And this will help eliminate the easy way for kids to identify another kid who may be low income that they could be targeted.
One of the things, Ben Kalos, that surprised me in reading about this, not necessarily in New York City, but in other school districts around the country where free lunch exists, and it does across the country, is that the shaming and the stigma that you were talking about wasn't necessarily directed at children, although peer-on-peer stigma is definitely an issue, that some school districts were exerting stigma and shaming on parents publicly with letters, with policies to try to get them to pony up. And I wonder what you have to say from your enclave in New York to this type of activity in school districts in other parts of the country.
Schools need to be a safe place for children and for parents. And one of the benefits of having a universal free school lunch means that there will no longer be a situation where kids who can't afford to pay for their meal have their meals thrown away or end up in some sort of debt situation where the school lunch workers or their teachers or even the principal are harassing the students or the parents to get paid for these meals. And it's something that if any jurisdiction is doing it, they should stop it. When we found out about it here in the city, the chancellor immediately sent out a memo saying, stop it. We're going to leave these kids alone. But the unfortunate fact is, with 1,400 different schools all over the city, those types of policies are hard to enforce. But what we can do is just say, school lunch is going to be free. We're going to leave our kids alone. We're going to leave our parents alone, and folks are going to be able to focus on learning.
1.1 million public school students in New York City returned to classes this week to find free school lunch for all students. Ben Kalos went to those New York City public schools as a kid, and now he's a member of the New York City Council representing the Upper East Side. Ben, thanks for being here.
Todd, thanks for having me.
Well, we've been hearing from many, many of you on your experiences with free or reduced lunch at school.
This is Jules from Erie, Colorado. I recall some kids got free lunch, but I think my parents were too proud to sign me up. I remember being really jealous of the kids that could afford school lunch as I ate my bologna and mustard sandwich on white bread. I was hungry at times, but I don't remember it distracting me from school.
This is Michael from Seattle. When I was a child, I was on free school lunch program. I didn't like waiting in the other line where all the other kids could be, but I also knew we were poor and that we needed the free lunch.
Sherry from Bee Cave, Texas. For a time, I was part of this free lunch program. It was embarrassing. Full, free, and reduced price lunch tickets were different colors then.
This is Eric Hamill in Philadelphia. I did rely on reduced price lunch when I was in junior high school. Since my family was also depending on food stamps at the time, I'm sure it helped me be adequately nourished or get the education I needed.
Well, what do you think? Has New York got it right here? Is free lunch for all the way to address the stigma of reduced lunch for some? Should other cities be doing the same? Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can send your tweets to us at The Takeaway, or you can join the conversation on our Facebook page. Thank you so much for listening today, and have a great weekend. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom.com. Providing American business owners with legal advice through its network of independent attorneys available in all 50 states. More information available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.